The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. You can find all the lines and available odds, of course, at the DraftKings Sportsbook app. North Carolina listeners, don't forget, DraftKings Sportsbook is now live in your state. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code SBNFL. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code SBNFL. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction, void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility, deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
It's the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. Hello, everybody. We're coming at you on a Thursday evening, a little different schedule. We thought not only that did John and I need a little breather on our usual Wednesday night based on what occurred just in a lot of different aspects of life yesterday, but we thought maybe everybody could use a little breather. But we are back. We're talking Bengals because there is a ton to talk about with the Cincinnati Bengals, even though their season is over. I'm Anthony Cazenza, joined by the guy in the stylish hoodie. I was complimenting him before we took the air there, John Sheeran. John, how you doing, bud?
Yeah, I like this hoodie, but as people can see on YouTube, it's like it's the hoodie that it's ingrained in my mind as like what AJ Green was in like 2019, because he always wore this like hoodie when he was just on the sideline. We always chose those pictures for AJ Green articles that season. It was just depressing because we never saw him in uniform. But yeah. I like the hoodie though. It's very comfortable.
It looks pretty sharp, man. I'm not lying. I'm a little envious. Yeah. Now that you mentioned that about AJ Green, I totally remember like when we do stories on Cincy Jungle, you pull up an AJ Green picture where he's kind of frustrated about something on the sideline.
Yeah.
I totally recognize it. Anyway. We got a lot to talk about tonight. A lot of news and notes surrounding the team. We don't usually go over the news and notes in the team, to start off a show, but there is a lot to get to. So we will do all of that, talking about the season ending, the coaching search, what's going on there. We've got a little Willie Anderson to talk about, Joe Burrow to talk about, a lot of different stuff to talk about tonight on that front. We're going to do a little 2020 season recap, maybe give out a couple of awards, maybe do some top moments. And then we're going to get on out of here and leave it at that. But let's get right to it, John. The Bengals end their season on an absolutely sour note against the Baltimore Ravens. Lose, you know, they score 6 points against the Ravens in 2 games this year. Pretty pathetic. Not much to talk about in terms of the game, I guess, but I just kind of some thoughts that you took away from that. And then we can talk about some coaching stuff from there based on some fallout this week.
It's funny that you brought up the 6 points, because the 3 points in the first game, it was a field goal that like the defense coordinator, Wink Martindale, like hated and it was so petty about. And the field goal in this last game was so obviously the same thing. Like they just didn't want to get shut out. And if they didn't hit that field goal, they would have lost 38-0. And it would have been a lot worse had Lamar Jackson exited the game after the third quarter. It was terrible. There's nothing more or less that you could say. I hate effort analysis and like saying, oh, this team's not trying or they gave up, because like it just feels hard to do that on the football field, and it's not something that I think any of us can fairly judge. But yeah. 404 rushing yards, that doesn't happen by accident. It has nothing to do with the fact that they had just had backup cornerbacks. Like that front seven out there, that's more or less the same front seven that they've had for the past several weeks, including weeks where they've been decent on defense. So it's inexcusable, but it's just the nature of what this matchup is. Like, this Ravens team is built perfectly to run all over the Bengals team. And it's symbolic, because they spent the entire offseason trying to gear up for these matchups and acquire this talent on defense. And basically none of that talent, aside from a couple of players, ended up playing in this game. And we saw the results of it. It was a decimation of biblical proportions, and it was terrible. There's nothing more you can say.
Yeah, I mean, I recapped it, and I don't want to beat a dead horse, but 404 rushing yards, the most ever given up by a Bengals team ever, the fourth most by an NFL team given up in a single game since 1950, fourth most. The tackling was atrocious on that side of the ball, so that's, I guess, where you could maybe have that quote-unquote effort conversation. The tackling was just non-existent, but like you said, I mean, the personnel has largely been the same over the past month or so on that side of the ball, and that performance was weak. I mean, yeah, Josh Allen, what was he, 6 of 21? I mean, just a pathetic performance on offense as well. All around, a really, really bad day. We thought, based on some of the progress we had seen the previous 2 weeks, maybe the Bengals would at least make a game of it, maybe even pull one out if we were trying to romanticize the thing, and it didn't didn't even come close. So it's once again kind of a stark reminder as to how far away the Cincinnati Bengals, at least from week 17 in 2020, how far away they are to competing with some of the AFC bad boys. And John, now a lot to catch up with in terms of the Bengals in the AFC North. Three teams made the playoffs, and those three teams all had 11 wins in the division, first time since 2002 when they really realigned the divisions that happened.
Yeah, you mentioned, like, we talked about this game leading up to it. It's like, oh, they can cap off those other two wins, the three-game win streak, and be like the greatest dead cat bounces of dead cat bounces. But no, they just fell flat. And, we had a feeling that most of this coaching staff was coming back, like definitely Zach after those two games. But all they had to do was not get humiliated like this. Because if this happens, then there was a chance that something could happen. But of course, you know, it's not the Bengals way. They don't react to just one game at the end of the season, even though, you know, throughout recent history, they've been able to hold on to certain coaches after performances in the final couple weeks. This game could have and maybe should have changed some things, but with 400 rushing yards allowed and 38 points and only 3 points on offense, nothing really. The thought process, the decision process didn't change, and everything remained the same. And that's what made it kind of shocking, I guess, the news that we're going to get to with this coaching staff. Like, this was the one game that in theory they shouldn't have been able to have in order for them to keep everything for the most part the way it is. And now only like one major change on this coaching staff after this performance, it really was not what they needed in order to sell the message that they're continuing to try to sell. And it just made, I guess, the news from this week a little bit more shocking than what I think we originally thought it was going to be. Because again, we thought that these guys, most of them are coming back, but after this performance, for them to basically act like it never happened, it was just a little awkward and a little strange to me.
Absolutely. We've talked about, you mentioned the coaches. We're going to talk about what we know so far as we sit here late in the week, the first week that the Bengals won't be going into a Sunday playing football. And you also talked about a message. So I shared this, I believe, on the Monday water cooler chat. I want to share it again real quick. It's the statement by Mike Brown. And I think I want to share this, John, kind of to your point about, you know, what we saw in the two games preceding the Ravens loss. We were like thinking progress, progress, progress. And if those two games were the impetus for Mike Brown to say, you know what, we got to keep some of these guys around that we're questioning, whether it's Brian Callahan, Lou Anarumo, Zach Taylor, some of the top coaches on this staff. And then, you know, like they give up a historically bad performance on defense, probably a near one on offense. And, you know, they still didn't really, they felt that what they saw in the 2 weeks prior was enough. So quickly, here is the, hopefully everybody can see this. This is from Bengals.com. I think everybody has seen or heard this right now. I just want to reread this real quick, John, and I want to get your take, because I haven't heard your take on this yet in terms of these words, because I thought this message was, there's truth to it, but it's almost like, where's the PR team? because I see it, basically our fans, quote unquote, from Mike Brown, our fans wanted a fresh new direction 2 years ago, and that is what we aim to do in hiring a bright, energetic head coach in Zach Taylor. We remain bullish on the foundation Zach is building, and we look forward to next year giving our fans the winning results we all want. In Zach's 2 years, we have added many new starters and contributors through the draft. We've invested heavily in free agency, and we have acquired a talented young quarterback with a bright future. The season we faced this season we faced challenges with injuries at key positions and missed opportunities. I am proud of our football team for fighting hard through adversity. That adversity and hard work will help us next season. We'll enter the offseason looking to shore up our weaknesses and amplify the strengths of our talented young core. We are not discouraged, but instead feel motivated and confident that next year we will reap the benefits of the work that has been done to date. We must capitalize on the opportunities in front of us. Next year, we will earn our stripes, John Sheeran. Next year, we're going to earn the stripes. I think Mo Egger of ESPN and Athletic kind of said something to the effect of the tone. I kind of felt this way, too, when I read it initially. I thought I was alone on that island, so it was kind of refreshing to hear Mo Egger talk about, like, it was almost like, hey, you asked for this. You asked for this, and this is what you're getting. I know that's not really what he kind of meant, but it really comes off that way, and I don't know. It just rubbed me the wrong way personally how it came off. I don't know if it's just because it's a sensitive time after two really bad seasons, but what did you think when you read that?
No, it's incredibly tone deaf, and I guess that's why they don't have Mike really saying anything anymore. And my whole opinion on Mike, I think people obviously despise him for obvious reasons. I don't think he doesn't want to win. I just think he doesn't really know how, and that's why he's regulated control for most of the operations to his daughter Katie, and Katie and Troy basically run the ship now, and he just is around to just be around. But this is kind of why he doesn't really say things at all, because he can't put it on the fans. He can't say that this is what the collective wanted. We didn't want 6.5 wins in 2 years after Marvin Lewis left town. We wanted progress from where that was. It was from taking from step B to step C. C means competing for championships, not just playoffs. So 6 wins in 2 years is not what we wanted. We wanted, obviously, to move on from that previous regime, but we wanted to do it correctly. And after 2 years of seeing this, for the most part, there's not a lot of confidence that everything is going in the right direction. And if everything revolves around the quarterback and the quarterback, you know, runs the ship, then maybe take a look at the coaching staff to see how they can make that quarterback a little bit better than what he is right now. So it was incredibly tone deaf, but also, I mean, to Mike's point, I guess, if you just want to throw out the Ravens game and act like it doesn't matter at all because of how depleted they were and because how outmatched they were against that team, then you also have to put it in context of the other two wins and the other wins that showcase the quote-unquote progress that they were making, going up against the Steelers team that had a terrible quarterback in Ben Roethlisberger, going up against the Texans team that was terrible aside from Deshaun Watson, and the fact that Deshaun Watson exposed that defense, you know, a week before the Ravens ran all over them, and the fact that the defense performed well against, again, bad offenses. There's context that we can provide with every situation of everything in that paragraph, and it all kind of leads back to the same thing. This is not good enough, and just because you started the process 2 years ago doesn't mean that you're excused from not starting it maybe a year earlier than what you could be doing this time next year.
Yeah, the statement was just, I don't know, it was very, very Mike Brown. For those who have followed this team for any length of time, it was just very Mike Brown. There was a lot of cliches, a lot of different phrases in there that, I don't know, you just, if you know Mike Brown, this really kind of wasn't that much, the verbiage wasn't very unexpected. But now the Cincinnati Bengals, going into the coaching situation, they've hung on to their head coach. Apparently they're hanging on to all three of their coordinators, special teams, offensive coordinator, and defensive coordinator. A lot of people thought maybe Lou Anarumo was going to be one of the guys that was going to be let go. Not apparently the case. It sounds like it's all going to be position coaches, lower-level guys. Please correct me if I forget someone here, John. The running backs coach, Jamal Singleton, has now moved on to the University of Kentucky. Bob Bicknell, the wide receivers coach, has moved on. I don't know if he's landed anywhere as of yet. You've got Jim Turner, the one that a lot of people wanted to see go, the offensive line coach. He is not being retained. And then, of course, who else am I missing? Defensive line coaches, Nick Eason and Chapman, I believe.
Gerald Chapman, yeah.
Yeah. So that's that. Those are the guys who are not being retained. They were here from, they were here this last year, and all of that. The Bengals now have moved on from those guys. Is it enough in your eyes? I mean, is that Is that going to be enough to propel them to being a competitive team next year, or is it dependent upon who they hire to replace those guys, or still not enough?
Well, the only one that really matters is Turner. And according to reports from The Athletic, like, it was a mutual parting. His contract just expired, and they both sides knew it was best for them to, you know, move on. Like, Turner didn't want to be there, and they knew that they had to put something on the offensive line struggle. So they just moved on from a career bad offensive line coach. I think Easton and Chapman, like, they go together because Chapman is a defensive assistant. And he basically took over for Easton when Easton was on the COVID reserve list to take over for the defensive line. And just kind of seems like they're placing all the issues on defense, on the lack of pass rush, and just putting on those assistants. I think those guys will be able to find jobs, you know, pretty soon. Easton was a pretty decent player, and I think he was just a hot name to come up a couple years ago in the coaching cycle there. You know, Bicknell and Singleton, it seems like, you know, those are just, I guess, kind of prominent names on the staff to, you know, fix issues at, you know, wide receiver and, I guess, get a new face and at running backs coach. But Anthony, like, like you said, the big news is Anarumo sticking around. And I think a lot of people thought that that wasn't going to be the case after the Ravens game. But I guess there is the angle of if you're putting Zach Taylor on the hottest of hot seats in 2021, is it smart, I guess, to go after a new defensive coordinator when the head coach that is going to hire him may only be around for a year? Is it just better to have all three of those guys, the hierarchy of this coaching staff, all here together in case they all just sink together, I guess, would be the argument.
Yeah, that, and that's a very good point. And the only other argument I can see for keeping Lou Anarumo, it's been embedded in what we shared there with when they talked about the free agency investments, they talked about, in you know, unfortunate missed opportunities and all that kind of stuff. I mean, the injuries, we knew that the Bengals were going to hang their hat on, you know, embed those excuses into what changes were or were not made this coming offseason. And I still think, to be fair to Lou Anarumo, we never saw really Geno Atkins next to DJ Reader. We didn't see DJ Reader for much of the season. We never saw William Jackson with Trey Waynes. We never saw the way this defense was meant to be designed because so many starters were out of the lineup. But on the same vein, injuries happen to every team, and they happen to a lot of different teams. You got to find ways to overcome that. So I think the main excuse maybe to keep a guy like Anarumo is kind of what you pointed to, John, which is, you know what, we're going to let these guys sink or swim together. And I think based on what we've seen, it might be the former and not the latter, but I think that's a good point about, you know, kind of maybe these guys will all go down together if it's a massive failure again next year.
Yeah. And I think going back to that statement, it just seemed like everything was pointed towards this roster was not competitive enough for this coaching staff to get the results that they desired. So they're putting it all on the lack of talent, which should signal for another sizable roster turnover this offseason and presumably more spending in free agency. But I don't know if I'm in the minority here, but I don't know how this roster is completely overturned and fixed completely in just one offseason. Like, this was always going to be a multi-year process, but they're now going to lose some progress because they're moving on from Geno Atkins. They already moved on from Carlos Dunlap. You kind of figured that both those guys would be around through at least the 2021 season, but now neither of those guys are going to be here. AJ Green's moving on. He doesn't have a long-term deal. There's a lot of core pieces that were going to fill valuable pieces on this roster that are not going to be here anymore. And that saves up cap space, but also creates holes that you need to fill immediately. So this roster was already like potentially fixable for this offseason, but now it's a little bit further behind. And then you have the Trey Hopkins news of him having a torn ACL, and you have another hole on the offensive line that you have to fill. And then you have a lot of pieces on defense that either need to be re-signed or replaced. It just seems like there's a lot of work to do on this roster, and it's not going to be completely fixed, where you can use that excuse as to, okay, the roster's fixed, now we can properly evaluate the coaching staff. Like you said, injuries happen to every team, and they happen to other teams like the Bengals in a more severe way. And you can't always put the injuries, like, you can't always have that excuse for the coaches. At some point, they need to produce results. And like it or not, this roster is going to have major holes in 2021, and this coaching staff needs to work to overcome it to earn to 2022.
So the Bengals have already started some work in terms of finding replacements, particularly at offensive line. We've got a couple of people asking us about, I think it was Lindsey Brilhart and others asking about our thoughts about the coach that the Bengals brought in as an offensive line coach candidate, Hank Fraley, who just old school throwback name. Love that. But he is a well-respected guy around the league. He got the Lions offensive line that has a couple of very good players and a couple of other just kind of, you know, rookies and journeymen along the line. He had them playing pretty well this year. Seems on, you know, at first blush, it seems to be something that would be a pretty good hire for the Cincinnati Bengals, especially coming off of the Turner era.
Yeah, I mean, like, really anybody who has a pulse is going to be looked as an upgrade over Chip Turner. Like, honestly, like, it was a bad hire from the start, and there were a lot of other quality candidates at that time, and there still are a lot of other quality candidates. I know Jay Morrison had Fraley as, like, his first option in an article that he wrote about potential O-line candidates before the report of Fraley being interviewed on Friday, and it does make a lot of sense. You know, he's only been an offensive line coach for one season, but he's been an assistant for a couple teams in the last decade or so. He was assistant with the Lions in the first 2 years, Matt Patricia. He was an assistant for Mike Zimmer's initial staff with the Vikings. He's a former player, and I think there is something to be said about former players then transitioning to assistant coaching roles. There's just respect that kind of comes with that. But there are also other options that they can look to. But I think Fraley is a good one to kind of start the search as, like, an up and coming guy who got progress out of that Lions offensive line as well. Like, in a way, they had, like, Taylor Decker, who's a solid starter left tackle, and Frank Ragnow, who could have been easily a Pro Bowler coming out of Arkansas. Now it has developed into a Pro Bowler. So it's like they just didn't mess up that part of his development, and he's become the player that they expected him to be. But other than that, they had to work with a lot of, like, late round guys and a lot of guys that they had to develop into their maximum potential, and they ended up producing a decent offensive line for the Lions. So the resume is definitely solid, but there are definitely other options out there that they should definitely be looking at.
Yeah, Pride of Detroit, the SB Nation site covering the Detroit Lions, this was relayed via the Bengals Talk Twitter account. Fraley was one of the Lions' best positional coaches in 2020 as center Frank Ragnow made the Pro Bowl. Left tackle Taylor Decker had one of his best years yet, and rookie guard Jonah Jackson made a solid NFL debut. That's a quote from an article on Pride of Detroit, so go check that out on Hank Fraley. So looks like a good hire. I know they should be putting feelers out to other people, John, but based on what happened in 2019, it's almost like if you feel like you got a good candidate, you probably got to get your hands on him quickly and get him in the building, because what happened in 2019 was a disaster. They couldn't get any kind of coaches to come here. So, I mean, I see your point about interviewing more, but I don't know. Would you be happy with his hire? He sounds on paper like a good hire.
Yeah, I think they could definitely do worse. And I guess the other one that we could talk about, because Bill Callahan's off the table, they're not going to be able to get an interview with him unless they offer him a promotion. And I don't think the Browns would allow the interview anyways. But Frank Pollock, I guess, is the other guy that fans are going to be talking about. And I want to get your take on this, because to me, it seems like we know for the most part how that relationship kind of ended. It was, you know, obviously Marvin Lewis got fired. Pollock was the guy to replace Paul Alexander. And he didn't stick around, because I feel like either he was not chosen by Zach Taylor as his coach, or Pollock just wanted to leave when Lewis got fired. So we don't know for sure how it ended up, but a reunion is possible. I just want to know how likely it is based on how it ended. Is it possible that he comes back after choosing to leave in the first place with the same head coach kind of still being there?
Yeah, based, again, from kind of the mile high view that I have and we have, and kind of the optics of his departure from a couple of off seasons ago, I would find it hard to believe that he would return. It just seems like, you know, there was kind of one of those mutual decisions, quote unquote, just like Jim Turner was a quote unquote mutual decision. I don't know that I fully buy that. I think that's a little bit of saving face there, but, you know, I just don't see Pollock coming back here unless it was just something to the, you know, Zach Taylor said, hey, I'm bringing in this guy who I'm very, very close to. It's nothing against you. This is just the guy I want to bring in, who would be Jim Turner. And maybe there aren't hard feelings there. I do remember, though, John, when Frank Pollock, I wish I could pull up the tweet here, when Frank Pollock left the Bengals, Joe Mixon immediately ran to Twitter and said, getting rid of our, like, our best coach or something to that effect. And that's a guy who, that's not his position coach. That's the offensive line's coach. And he said that that's the best coach he played with. And if you remember in 2018, Joe Mixon, much like at the end of 2019, Joe Mixon went on a tear at the end of 2018 with Jeff Driscoll at quarterback. So, you know, he was one of the best running backs in the AFC behind an offensive line that ended up playing better that second half of the year with names like Alex Redmond. I think Christian Westerman was maybe in there once or twice. And I think Clint Bowling was hurt at the end of that year, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to go back and look. But basically, very patchwork offensive line, and Frank Pollock was doing something exceptional, as was Joe Mixon behind it. So I think it would be a good hire. I just find it unlikely based on kind of a little bit of what we think we saw a couple of years ago. I don't know that a reunion is going to take place, personally speaking.
Right. And, of course, someone else that we hear all the time is the guy that – almost made the news this weekend, Willie Anderson. We've talked a lot about, and we had Willie on the show, and he, you know, mentioned that he loves what he does as a player development coach, and he would accept like a consultant role, but Willie Anderson's not gonna be the O-line coach. But Willie Anderson was, I guess, kind of in the news this week. He was a semifinalist for the 2021 Pro Football Hall of Fame class. Unfortunately, 15 names were mentioned, and he was not one of them. Were you surprised by this? Because unfortunately, I wasn't really surprised that much.
I wasn't surprised from the fact of what his resume is or was. I was surprised at the fact that I was not surprised based on the team that he largely played for in the era that he played in. I mean, that's just kind of how it goes with a lot of Bengals players. And, you know, now a lot of people, these analysts and powers that be that cover the NFL, you know, we kind of scoff a little bit at Pro Bowl nominations because it's kind of more of a popularity contest and not necessarily the best players make it from their respective positions. Jesse Bates. You know, I'm not surprised, and I don't know what it's going to take for some of these guys that are very deserving. And there's going to be guys that will be brought up in conversations. Chad will be in that conversation. I'm sure Corey Dillon will be in that conversation. There's going to be a lot of guys. Ken Anderson and Ken Riley are still in that conversation where you go, what's it going to take? What's it going to take? Is it going to take the team to win? Is it going to take a more engaging personality in the front office to getting the name of the Cincinnati Bengals out there? Is it going to take a Ring of Honor? I don't know. But he's a guy who's deserving, even though he only had, four Pro Bowl nods. It's because he was on a terrible team for a really long time, and he didn't get his due. He was the most dominant right tackle in his era. And, you know, unfortunately, in his era, it was all the left tackles that were getting all the run, and he kind of got overlooked.
I think there's some weight that you can say that just being a semifinalist kind of kickstarts your momentum into eventually getting in there. Like he said, the conversation has started. You know, there's at least some publicity about this going on right now. But also, Tony Boselli and Alan Faneca have been semifinalists for years now, and both those guys are now finalists. And I think it would help a lot for Willie if at least one of those guys eventually gets in. Like Boselli obviously played in the same era as Willie did in the early years of the Jaguars. And obviously the Jaguars weren't tremendously good. I think they had some success, obviously, in the 90s. But he doesn't have a ring, but Faneca, like a dominant guard for the Steelers, for a team that was consistently making the playoffs, like the fact that he hasn't gotten in, I think obviously still, like, I guess, pisses off some Steelers fans as well. So for at least one of those guys, or maybe both those guys, to get in, the list kind of then decreases, and then Willie kind of starts to rise up to the top of potential names that eventually will get in. So I think it would help for other guys to get in before him. It just doesn't seem likely for, again, like you said, the era of Bengals football that he played in, the fact that the Bengals were a joke for the most part that he played for them. It's hard, even with people knowing who he is and him playing kind of later in, you know, in the media era when there was more highlights, I guess, of those teams. It's hard for that stigma of playing for that bad of a team to help your case, despite how dominant that you were.
It's a shame. And you know, Willie was all class. If you followed him on Twitter, he was all class about not making it to the finalist round. Even if he made it to the finalist round of that 15, I don't, you know, probably would have been snubbed from there as well. I mean, it's just kind of the unfortunate truth there. And it's not, again, it's not because he's not deserving. He's a very, very, he was an excellent football player. It's just a matter of, you know, who else was in his era, the team he played for, and all of that. But to your point too, going back a second, I do not think that either party is going to want Willie Anderson to be the offensive line coach. I think he's pretty content in working with high school kids and doing what he's doing. And then I think the Cincinnati Bengals are just looking elsewhere. You know, I that's just my take on it. I don't know if you feel differently, John, but I don't see the fit there.
No, and even if he is offered, I don't know why he would take it. I think he loves what he does, and I think that job is so much more fulfilling than being an offensive line coach. I think if he had the ambition of being a coach in the NFL, he probably would have taken that route already, because he could definitely thrive in it if given the chance. But I think he's very comfortable where he is, and I'm glad he is comfortable where he is, because I think he's doing a great job.
Yeah, he's done a couple little like internship things, but I think it's not more to get his foot in the door to be an NFL coach. I think it actually is more to help his like consultancy business with offensive linemen and stuff. I think that's it, kind of worked the reverse thing. John, real quick before we move into some Joe Burrow stuff, Chuck Anderson says, "Do you just quick little non sequitur, I guess, but does Whitworth get into the Hall of Fame in your opinion based on this conversation? Because now this guy's Mr. Fine Wine, right? Just seems to get, he's even better with the Rams than he was with the Bengals, it seems. What do you think on that one?
I think he does, actually. Legitimately fine wine. Like, people talk and tout Frank Gore all the time. Frank Gore, like, came out just 1 year before, I think, Whitworth did in the NFL. And Whitworth came into the NFL as a 24, 25-year-old rookie. And the fact that at 39, 40 years old, he's still playing at a legitimately high level. He's not just trucking along like Frank Gore is at this point with cement in his legs. Like, he's still a top notch left tackle. Yeah. And if the Rams had won that Super Bowl a couple years ago, I think you would have confirmed that Whitworth would eventually get into the Hall of Fame. But at this point, he definitely has a tremendous case to at least get in sometime down the line. I don't know if he gets in, it'll be immediately, obviously, but I think he does have one of the better cases of any former Bengal out there right now.
Yep. And news today too, after his, you know, pretty somewhat severe knee injury that he had, I think it was midway through the season, right? Midway, late.
Yeah. Portion. And now he's back.
He's back. And he may even start this week, they said. So for the Rams in the game against Seattle. So go Wit, you know, I mean, got to root for that guy. Awesome guy. John, much has made the rounds on Twitter and whatnot, because Joe Burrow has kind of done one of his more one of the most high profile interviews, definitely the most high profile interview that he has done since his injury. He appeared on Colin Cowherd's The Herd on Fox Sports Radio and the channel FS1. I know a lot of people that cover the Bengals put out a lot of quotes, some videos, etc. We're going to share just a brief clip of it with you. It's probably like a 10-12 minute segment, so we can't do the whole thing, but we've been doing sound bites of the week throughout most of the season. So we're going to kind of embed this sound bite of the week here, and we're going to talk a little bit about what we heard in the interview. Joe Burrow talking with Colin Cowherd. I'm going to cue this up here one sec. I'm going to go about a little bit into the interview and go maybe a minute or so into it. And then we'll chat about that there. But here is Joe Burrow on Colin Cowherd's show.
I thought you had a spectacular year until the injury. We had said by week two, I mean, I just said, this kid, there's an it. He's better than Romo, and I loved Romo. I thought Romo was a gamer. How would you evaluate your rookie year? Let's take the injury out of it, the games you play.
You know, I think I played well for the most part. You know, I have some pretty tough games, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, come to mind, that, you know, going into next year, I need to be more consistent in those big games. But I think for the most part, I played well. I was really efficient. But, you know, there's still some things that obviously need to be corrected. I wasn't great with the deep ball, which I was pretty disappointed in, because I've always been pretty good at that. So that's an emphasis for me going into this offseason is hitting those big plays and creating outside the offense and creating those big plays on my own.
This may sound like a weird question, but you're an Ohio kid, and all of a sudden you're quarterbacking an Ohio team. You're facing the Steelers. You're facing the Browns. Was there a moment in your rookie year when you literally went under center and thought, this is surreal? Literally, my dad's a college coach. I'm a high school player. I left Ohio. I came back. Now you're in this division, which is tough. Cleveland and Ohio and Pittsburgh. Was there a pinch yourself moment this year for you?
You know, not during the season. Leading up to the draft, you know, knowing where I was going to go, I think it was exciting for me to come back to Cincinnati, come back to Ohio, and actually get to play for the fans. But you know, during the season, there's no time for that. You got to win games. You got to play well right now. Otherwise, you know, you see what's happening across the league. If you don't play well, you know, people are trying to run you out of town. So there's no time to pinch yourself, say, wow, that's the Steelers. Wow, you know, I'm playing Thursday night football against the Browns. you got to play well.
Did you hit it off with Zach Taylor, your head coach, quickly? Or did it take a while?
It was immediate. You know, I think Zach is going to be a great coach for a long time. You know, I'm happy to be in the position that I'm in and to help build this organization, but it's going to be on Zach's back. He's the leader of what we're trying to do, and he's awesome.
Yeah. Does he ever
– So let's stop it there, John. I mean, we could go on and on again. This is a 13-minute interview. I said 10 to 12 minutes. It's actually longer than that. I don't want to poach Colin's show to make his show our show, but some interesting stuff there. A lot to get to. By the way, just one other thing that we'll tack on at the end. There was a really, really cool moment at the end when Colin asked him, you know, is he going to be ready at for week one next year? And he kind of said with a smirk, basically, you know, yeah, I'm pretty sure I'll be fine. It'll be fine. And confidence, confidence, confidence. That's what this kid exudes. Where do you want to start here, John? Do you want to start? I kind of want to start with the Zach Taylor comments, personally. The last question he asked him about Zach Taylor. Number one, do you believe it? Number two, do you think that answer right there, if you do believe it, is why Zach Taylor is coming back in 21 and that alone?
I think it's obvious that they enjoy working together. Like it's been a partnership that's existed since what, like February, March of last year when they just communicated before the draft. Zach being the coach that he is, the experience as a coach that he has, it's obvious, like he knows how to communicate with a guy like Burrow and just quarterbacks in general. I think that is genuine. Of course, he can't like speak on, you know, other management issues with how he, you know, manages the team and stuff like that. But for the most part, like Burrow's comments kind of match other veterans like Gio and CJ Uzomah and Tyler Boyd, and they all kind of stick up for him. And along the same vein, like this guy is a good leader of our team and of our locker room. And I think, you know, he kind of hinted at it towards, you know, the end there. Like it is on his back. Like people say that this is Burrow's team and he galvanizes them and he's the leader and he's the voice of the locker room. But at the end of the day, like a lot of responsibility, if not most responsibility, falls on the head coach and Zach. And I appreciate him kind of clarifying that and giving him the full brunt of responsibility, because if they don't win, it's going to be looked at on Turner. It's going to be an indictment on him, because we see Burrow and we see a known commodity, a legitimately good NFL quarterback, even at this stage in his career. And if they're not winning, it's probably have something to do with that coach. And that's not what he was saying, but it is true. Like he has that full blunt of responsibility of putting this team in the best position to compete and win. And I think it was good that he did say that.
If there's something that Mike Brown has learned or has become known to value from his father, it's that you got to have continuity at quarterback and have a good one there. And they really like the skill position guys. They like wide receivers. They like flashy running backs. They like those guys. On the quarterback front, I am betting the house that Mike Brown does not want to go through any kind of situation like he went through with Carson Palmer in terms of having this franchise quarterback being disgruntled, quit on the team, and have, you know, the team's name, his family's name dragged through the mud publicly by a lot of different people. So that's why I think, you know, this is going back to our sink or swim type of conversation about this coaching staff that may play into this, right? Like he may say, you know, Burrow wants you back. you guys got a lot to prove. He got hurt this year. If this doesn't work this year and Burrow either gets hurt again or, you know, it's not up to snuff, we're cutting bait. And I don't know. That was kind of a train of thought I went through today as I listened to Joe talk.
It's hard to compare this franchise to really any in the league, but there is, I think, an example that I think everybody should look to, and it's the Texans. And they drafted a quarterback, and he got hurt in his first year. He tore his ACL, and he came back, and they kept that same head coach, that same incompetent head coach, for 4 years of his career. 4 great years of his career that they fired him, they moved on from him. And now, according to reports, like, Deshaun Watson's disgruntled with Houston. You know, I think everybody can agree that Deshaun is a great kid, and he's a great quarterback, and he's a great leader, and everything that goes with that. But if it can happen to Deshaun Watson and the Texans, it could easily happen to Joe Burrow and the Bengals. And we look at Burrow as just the guy that can't say anything wrong. He's a perfect, you know, PR guy, and he says all the right things, and he's just the ideal leader, franchise quarterback, and everything. If things don't improve eventually, there's no telling what he'll say and what message that he'll convey towards everybody else and give this team a bad name. If they don't continue to do the right things or start doing the right things around him, like, they can't count on Burrow to just remain loyal and not want to move on for the betterment of his career, or not have that relationship kind of, you know, tarnished to a point where it's beyond repair, like it ended up being with Carson Palmer. So it's great that they have the support of Burrow, but at the end of the day, Burrow has only played 11 games in his career, and he's got that humility and humbleness to know that he still has a lot to prove. But once he starts proving and everybody realizes that it's not on him, it's on the rest of this team, things can easily change.
Yeah, and, you know, even this injury, what struck me about this interview, even with this injury, even with, you know, him only winning 2 games in the games that he started as an NFL quarterback, the confidence level's still there. The confidence in the staff and the direction of the team is still there. And I guess it kind of plays into my last question too, you know, how much is this towing the company line and how much is it believable? It seems in his tone of voice that he believes what he's saying. And I'd like to believe him as well. It's just, you know, some of the records also. So it's kind of hard to know what we're dealing with here.
No, but I honestly do believe that he's being genuine. I think the comments that we hear from other players, they are honestly genuine. I think people like Zach Taylor for who he is, but at the end of the day, if the results don't come, that tone can easily change.
Yep. Any other takeaways that you got out of that or from the interview? I'm sure you've seen it by this point, but anything else that you found particularly interesting aside from the fact that he's pretty confident that he will be back for week one?
Yeah, he did mention, you know, he was not only confident he was going to be back week one, but he was going to end up practicing a little bit in training camp, which would be an unbelievable win. The whole consensus was that it was a 9-month recovery process and that would get him right up to week one. But if he's able to take some practice reps, obviously non-contact, sometime in late August or early September, that's advantageous for the Bengals. But I also loved how he kind of broke down that game losing interception against the Colts. Yeah. And kind of took Coward off guard a little bit. I mean, he just went out to all this football jargon and whatnot, and just breaking down the play from a schematic standpoint. And I think he's just dying to get back into it. You know, he's in California just rehabbing, doing stuff he doesn't want to do. He just wants to get back into the facility and kind of prepare for next year.
Yeah, and I think he's, if I remember correctly, I think he is heading back to Paul Brown Stadium to do some stuff in the near future here. But yeah, it's a good point about that one with the Colts. The Colts game is what he was kind of breaking down, and the interception that sealed the game there. And he actually apologized at one point to Colin, kind of saying, "Oh, sorry, I'm just kind of going on a rant here." And Colin's like, "No, go for it." Very entertaining interview, courtesy of Colin Cowherd in The Herd on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. I know Colin has some critics and some fans and all of that, but he does provide quite a bit of entertainment regardless, and that was a very entertaining interview. You can find it on their channel. You can find it on their Twitter account, all that kind of stuff. Go check it out. This is the Orange and Black Insider Bengals podcast. We're going to maybe try and get to – we're going a little long on some of this stuff, but we're going to try and get to maybe some season awards and maybe some top moments of the year if we've got some time. He's John Chiron. I'm Anthony Cazenza. Get this show on your favorite audio streaming platform, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, Megaphone, iHeartRadio, all those. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. There's a little logo right on John's nice sweater that he's wearing tonight. You can click that and subscribe to our channel to know when we go live, when new stuff is available, as well as when Chalk Talk episodes from Matt Minnick are available on the channel. So check that out.
All right, we're going to transition to what ideally is like a little fast-paced back and forth here. We're going to do season awards. Not a lot of awards to really give out on another losing season, but you know we're going to start with an interesting one. We're going to go coach of the year, and I believe both of our answers last year were special teams coordinator Darren Simmons. I have a different one this year. What do you think?
Ooh, you know, I am actually inclined to stick with Darren Simmons again, I think. You know, I guess that's maybe a little bit of a cop-out on my end. The one issue is his sticking with certain field goal kickers. And then when you try out the other one, it's really not much better of a result towards the end of the season. And then sticking with Alex Erickson at punt returns when there's just an insane amount of fair catches that should not be made and not many big plays coming from the punt return game. I like Alex Erickson. I like what he's done for a long time for this team, but there just doesn't seem to be the same spark this year. But other than that, you know, Kevin Huber had a nice year and, you know, Brandon Wilson had another record. He had a franchise record setting kickoff return. And, you know, special teams was definitely not the reason why this team was losing games this year for the most part.
That's a good one. I think I'm going to go in a different direction. I'm going to focus on defense. I was picking between Al Golden, the linebackers coach, and Robert Livingston, the safeties coach. And I think I'm leaning towards Livingston because I think there's just a stigma of Golden being the third down play caller and obviously not a lot of success on defense with that. But Livingston has been around the team for the better part of the last decade, started off as a scout. Then he worked his way up to a secondary assistant. Now he's been coaching the safeties for a couple of years. And obviously the big viewpoint with this is Jesse Bates, you know, from going from a really good player, but really inconsistent player to just an elite player in his third year to be Pro Football Focus's best graded safety, arguably the best free safety in the NFL right now, but also to integrate Von Bell into this defense as well, to get solid performance out of him for the second half of the season. And also integrating Brandon Wilson, like you mentioned, into the defense in some of those dime packages to get all three of those guys working together. Ideally, I guess you would have liked to see a role kind of carved out for Sean Williams, but I think the play from Bates and Bell and even Wilson at times on some of those crucial passing downs really helped keep the defense afloat. And obviously Bates, I think Derek Klassen on Twitter at QB Class, he said it best, like Bates is just like putting out all these insane fires that the rest of the Bengals defense kind of creates. He's just running around there with like a fire hose and just putting out these incredible flames that the rest of the defense, that, you know, how they cause problems and whatnot. He just did his best to make sure everything was controlled, and he ended up getting like 15 combined pass deflections and pass breakups. And I think Livingston, a guy who's still fairly young on this coaching staff, has done a lot to help develop the consistency with Bates. And obviously there's continuity with a defensive scheme in general, but I think the safeties were like the strongest point on this team in general. And I think Livingston deserves credit for that.
That's a very, very good point. Very good point. And I wouldn't debate you on that really. We kind of got some comments about coach of the year. This coaching staff was not very good this year. I understand, but hey, we do season awards. You know, if you've played sports and you've done like the banquet thing, and there's all kinds of little individual awards, team awards, all that kind of stuff. That's kind of what we're trying to embody here. Where do you want to go next, John? I was thinking maybe most improved player. What do you think about that?
Sure, we'll go most improved. I was also kind of troubled with this because you could easily go Bates for how, you know, how much he's ascended, but I think I'm going to go Carl Lawson as a guy who, along with Bates, has always been a little bit inconsistent. He's had obviously injuries to deal with, but his ascension, especially towards the second half of the season, it was incredible to watch. And, you know, early in the season, people were like, you know, is this guy really that good? He's not getting a lot of sack numbers and not getting a lot of pressures. I mean, the rest of the defensive line just wasn't there and hasn't been there for the entire season. And the fact that he basically carried it for the entire season and carry the pass rush while it just was decimated by injuries and inconsistent play, for him to develop into a top of the line pass rusher and someone who should probably get paid as such in a contract year, I think he deserves credit for that.
I like it. I thought about a lot of different players on this one. Some that are younger that have kind of stepped up. Some that are, towards the end of their careers. I'm kind of leaning towards Mike Daniels, based on what we saw last year with the injuries and all of that, and what he was able to provide this team in the wake of so many injuries. He had an injury as well, but towards the end there, he was a really important player as to what they were doing up front. And our buddy Sans, S-A-N-S, who does a lot of similar stuff, I should say, to Coach Matt Minnick on Twitter. Go check out his film review stuff. He's done a lot of stuff on Mike Daniels that I found, pretty interesting. And John, you've done some stuff as well on him and Margeson. I think one of your weekly linemen that we have up on our channel talks about that. And I looking at that kind of stuff, I'm like, Mike Daniels is just quietly doing a lot of work. And I guess I've got a soft spot for him because he's come on the program a couple of times and he was just an outstanding interview. But, for a guy that was on a rental deal, you kind of figured at best he'd be a nice rotational piece, was thrust into a really big role and I think stepped up, even though the defense didn't play well overall, I think you could say he's most improved, particularly based on how his season went with Detroit the year prior.
That's fair. I think he's a candidate for this next one, which would be Unsung Hero of the Year.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the one Leo Sean talked about here, about Margus Hunt. That was the guy I had for that. I hope I didn't steal yours there, John. But that was a guy I was thinking about. A guy, again, that edge guy, and they've moved him inside a bit. He has played the edge. Nothing spectacular, but he had it. He got his paw up a couple of times late in the season that caused big turnovers. I think the one against Baltimore this last week and then a big one in Pittsburgh. I think you diagnosed that one on your weekly lineman, if I remember correctly, John. So a couple tackles for loss. And again, when I've done these awards on CincyJungle.com, Unsung Hero a lot of times is a guy who steps in and plays well because someone else is injured or just kind of rises above expectation. And that's kind of where I've come to feel this way about Margus Hunt. This was a guy I laughed when they signed this guy. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, really? And he's come in and he's played pretty well. For what he's been expected to do and what he has given them, I would say that's the guy I was looking at.
Yeah, it's a wonder where Hunt has been for the past 7 years. Apparently he's been in the NFL for 7 years. I just don't remember him before this, but it was a good signing. The guy I'm going to go is Trey Hopkins. The most consistent player on the offensive line, the only guy who started like 15 games on this offensive line and continued to play at a solid level. The fact that he had just turnstiles at both guard spots throughout the season just didn't help. It was unfortunate what happened at the end of the season to tear his ACL in such a meaningless game. It was definitely heartbreaking, but I'm very glad that he got paid last season. He definitely earned that paycheck because without him, the offensive line would be a lot worse.
I like it. And I don't know what the future holds for him because that's a very, very last game of the season. He tears a knee ligament. And so now you go, what does that mean for next year? And you could, like you said, pretty much the best offensive lineman this team had this year. And now you got him with a knee injury. You've got Jonah Williams with a knee injury, though not a tear, but it's just not the way you wanted to end the year on a struggling offensive line with two of your best guys having knee injuries. Where do you want to go next?
Let's go comeback player of the year.
This was tough for me because there's guys that technically came back and played okay. If they were injured, you could look at AJ Green and say, there's just a lot of downs with some of the ups, but he did play the entire season. There are a couple of other, you can say Jonah Williams, but then he ended up leaving early with injury. I'm inclined maybe to go Drew Sample just because he gave the team a little bit more than what was expected, and he gave them pretty much nothing last year as a second round pick. So I don't think I have a strong answer regardless of who I would pick here, unless I'm just missing someone that's glaringly obvious and you make me look pretty dumb here. But I that's one guy that kind of popped to mind for me.
I think that the going into the season, the favor was AJ. And there might even still be an argument for the fact that he did play the entire year and had productive, like a handful of productive games. But yeah. I am going to go with Jonah Williams just for the fact he just missed his entire rookie season. He hadn't played football in like 600, 700 days up from like the 2019 national championship up until week one where he faced Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram. And he had some rough moments for sure. But as a first-year left tackle coming off of a season-ending injury, I think he played extraordinarily well. And I think there is definitely a lot of upside with him still, and he can definitely still be improved, especially now that he'll hopefully have a competent offensive line coach. So for them to get what he gave them as far as pass blocking production as a first year player coming off the injury, I think it was definitely well deserved.
Much more pleasant to watch than the merry-go-round of John Jerry and God knows whoever else last year. Much, much better when Jonah Williams was in there. Let's go to rookie of the year, right? Joe Burrow probably would have ran away with this one had he stayed healthy the entire season. By the way, Pro Football Focus graded the Bengals draft class as the number one draft class by their metric. So go check that out. That was kind of neat. I guess I would go T. Higgins simply because of the Burrow injury, but a good class all around this year. What do you think?
I still want to go Burrow just because he just met expectations after so much expectations were put on him. And for the sake of devil's advocate, I think I'm going to go to Logan Wilson, actually. As someone I didn't have a lot of expectations for, to kind of just grind his way into the rotation at linebacker as the year went on. And there just weren't a lot of negative plays with him after like the first handful of weeks in this defense, where again, it was a dumpster fire for the most part. But I think he played pretty well behind, you know, a revolving door of defensive tackle rotation. And it was refreshing to see, you know, a young linebacker for the Bengals to just kind of be in his spots and read his keys and get into his fits and also be an adapt player in coverage. He just had more good plays than bad. And it seems that's extremely rare for any Bengals linebacker, nonetheless a rookie linebacker. Higgins obviously deserves to make, you know, honorable mentions for all rookie teams, and Burrow definitely would have been a candidate for rookie of the year had he stayed healthy. But as far as where my expectations were, I think Logan Wilson surpassed it most.
That's a good point. I mean, created a couple of turnovers and, you know, kind of provided quite a bit of what has been missing at that position for a while. And I think he's a bit older in terms of a rookie, right? He got a little older.
It's my age, exactly.
The old man, cool. Right?
Yeah.
And I know sometimes that is, a knock on guys as they come out of the draft, but sometimes it does, in a position like him, sometimes it does pay dividends a bit, having some of that experience. Like you said, he was in the right spot more often than not. And that's a key thing here. What do you think? I want to just wrap it up here with MVP.
Let's go free agent of the year. I think right before then. I don't know. I think Von Bell is the answer, if not just for his one play against the Steelers and Juju Smith-Schuster, a guy that battled a lot of like negative attention because he got picked on in coverage a few times. And just, I mean, there's no reason why he should be a deep safety anymore, or be in those coverage shells at all. But I think when he was utilized to what he does best, he was a solid player. And I think at the end of the day, he graded out as one of their top players on defense. And for what they signed him for and what they expected out of him as a leader and just as a consistent player on defense, and the fact that he just stayed healthy, unlike DJ Reader and Trey Williams, unfortunately, I think he's the clear winner here.
Yeah, I'm almost inclined to go. That's a good one. I'm almost inclined to go with Reader simply because of the drop-off that was seen when he was not in the lineup. It's kind of like it's almost like winning a most valuable player because you see how the team reacts when you're not in the lineup and it's not good type of thing. You could go, to me, this is kind of a coin flip. You can go Mike Daniels, you could go Von Bell. I mean, I guess since you went with Von Bell, I guess I would say Mike Daniels again for this one. Because, you know, like I said, a lot of these guys, these high profile guys have been hurt and they just weren't able to provide much this year. Also, actually, let me backtrack. I got one for you. I'm going to go Mackenzie Alexander.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like what he brought this year. I hope he's a guy that they retain. You know, I feel like he brought a lot of what they had hoped Darquez Dennard would have brought for them in the slot. A lot of physical play, a big, big, big game against the Steelers, and a couple of really nice games. There were a couple of times he was beat, but missed a couple of games from injury, but overall pretty steady. I think he's earned himself a decent contract here. I hope it's with the Bengals next year. So I'll say Mackenzie Alexander.
And just like that, Mike Daniels has declined an invitation back on the show.
I know.
All right, let's end it on MVP. I feel like this should be pretty obvious. Or maybe it isn't. I don't know.
Yeah. Ryan Finley. No. I guess this is a hard one. Would I go Higgins on this one? I guess I would go Higgins on this one, maybe. He started really slow. Offensive production. Let's pump the brakes there. I guess we'll go Bates. I mean, I think Bates has to be the guy. Jesse Bates. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the argument for Burrow is obviously there for what the drop-off was and how much he carried the offense when no rookie really needs that all that pressure. But I mean, Bates, the fact that he's not a Pro Bowler and maybe not even an All-Pro, yeah, the fact that he had a legitimate argument for being Defensive Player of the Year, and like we talked about, just putting out all these fires around him and making so many impact plays, he's the clear MVP as far as guys who played the entire year.
Yeah, yeah. I overlooked him too briefly for a moment there, but yeah, Bates has to be the guy. Pro Football Focus metric king this year, and absolute joke that he was not nominated to the Pro Bowl. But so those are our season awards, John. Do we have time to do some of the top moments? Do we want to save that for another show here? We're already an hour in. Up to you, my friend.
I don't know. Like, I feel like we have time for like maybe one each if you want to just do that, unless you want to save them all for one segment.
There's not a bunch of great moments.
All right.
But go for it.
After that second Browns loss, I legitimately thought that this team was just spiraling downwards out of control. And no one thought that they were going to beat the Titans, even compete against the Titans. So for them to play as well as they did against an eventual division winner who for some reason just didn't want to hand the ball off to Derrick Henry and put it all on Ryan Tannehill, for them to be competitive throughout that game and have so many iconic Joe Burrow moments, but just one that really just stood out, just the throw to Tyler Boyd in the red zone when Boyd wasn't even looking, and then Boyd just turns around, the ball just magnetizes into his grasp. They get into the red zone. I think Giovanni Bernard scores a touchdown a couple plays later. Like, there's just so many other Joe Burrow moments that make you think this guy is legit, but in that game, to make everybody so clueless of how that was even possible, I think that's the moment that really stands out.
This is one of the moments here that you're talking about, John, the Tyler Boyd touchdown. And this, to this point, we'll keep this on loop here for folks to enjoy. And this was a great win for the Bengals. We really thought they turned a corner at this point. And, there were a lot of really, really fun plays in this game. And it was a surprising result. Good win for Zach Taylor and company. I mean, there's only four to really discuss at this point. This was definitely one of the moments there that you had to like. I don't know. You kind of just felt that this was going to be a stepping stone game for them. And unfortunately, the injury and all of that. In that Joe Burrow interview, by the way, on Colin Cowherd, he just outright said, we felt like there were a lot of winnable games on the end of this schedule, largely talking about the NFC East and other games that they had. Playing him rematching some of the AFC North teams, Pittsburgh and Baltimore. You kind of got a feel that unfortunately that was a win that felt good, but did not lead to where we wanted it to lead to. I'm going to share one more here. This is obviously, I love what Joe Burrow brought, but we've been wanting a little bit of balance, and we wanted to see Joe Mixon play well. Here's one of the runs here against the Jacksonville Jaguars. And then, of course, this one was after the big run up the middle, a big day from Joe Mixon and the Bengals offense to get their first win of the year, week 4 against Jacksonville. They had been so close the previous weeks, you know, the Thursday night game against the Browns and, you know, other games there that you felt that they were close, the tie against the Eagles, and they just weren't getting it done. And they finally got off the schneid here. You see, they were 0-2-1 at this point, and they were really dominating the Jacksonville Jaguars. Even the score didn't totally note that, John. They, you know, they were controlling the line of scrimmage and doing a lot of positive things in that game. So that had to be one of the better moments of the year, too.
Listeners probably hate us for not mentioning Von Bell's hit.
Well, I was going to pull that up next. I was going to surprise you, but go ahead.
No, I mean, it's, again, a game that no one expected to be fun in any way, shape, or form. I personally don't know how, like, Juju's dance could be motivating at all. It just seemed cringe to me, but I'm not a football player. I don't see this happen, and I don't know how to compartmentalize it or just factor it into my process of getting prepared for playing a game. But it was something that Bell talked about earlier that week. You know, it's disrespectful, but we got to make sure that, you know, when we send the message, we put it between the lines. And you couldn't have asked for a more legal and dominating hit than what Von Bell did. And it just sends shockwaves throughout the entire, you know, NFL media. And it was a primetime game, and everybody saw it. And it really just set the tone for the rest of that game. Like, a game that, again, nobody expected the Bengals to win. Even when they were up 17, no one expected them to hold that lead. But they just kept that same intensity after that hit. Even before that hit, it was unlike anything I really ever seen before, especially in that matchup and in that setting. It's why Von Bell is what he is, and why he deserved, you know, free agent of the year, I guess, in that honor. But it was a moment that it was very unique to me and something I've never really seen before as a Bengals fan.
Yeah, we always talk about the Steelers, the Bengals needing to out-Steeler the Steelers or punch them in the mouth for however many times they have done it to the Bengals. And, you know, what was it? 10 straight games they had lost to the Steelers at this point, right? Something like that.
Yep.
So, you know, it was really kind of finally giving it back to the bully, even if it was just this one play alone. But the Bengals came to play that night for sure. They came to play on defense. They came to play on offense, which is saying something with Ryan Finley, even though he only threw for, I don't know, 80 some yards. But I mean, they were just making plays in the run game, making a lot of plays on defense, and taking advantage of a Steelers team that was trying to find its identity at the time. But still, I mean, the Steelers are the Steelers, and they made the postseason with 12 wins. So it was a quality win on primetime TV. So you have to like that. And it's just kind of poetry in motion, given that you kind of mentioned it, Juju dancing at the 50-yard line, and then this hit occurring right around the logo he was dancing on. So, I mean, it was just kind of like, wow, what a storyline there. I do want to ask, when I immediately saw this, John, I was like, oh, why'd they blow that dead? I saw that it looked like he had, even live, it looked like he had those three steps, and it was a fumble. Did you think that, or were you like, incomplete pass, or were you just celebrating in general, didn't really pay attention?
I thought it was a fumble. I wasn't shocked that they kind of picked up, like, they negated the Jordan Evans recovery. I was, I think, more concerned or just questioning if it was going to be like flagged or not for like an illegal hit, because I mean it's a bang bang play, and it's easy to see a ref kind of like throwing that flag on instinct. But I mean, we've seen the replay hundreds and thousands of times, and it was as legal as it gets, and it was definitely a fumble. He took at least two steps and had possession. So, again, though, like, if that happens, and especially if the Bengals are like relevant and they're in the postseason hunt, and that moment happens, it usually gets taken away or it's diminished in some way, shape, or form. But it stayed true, and you know, regardless of what the win kind of meant for the season and for the team in general, it's something that not all of us are going to forget anytime soon.
Yep, and hopefully, it's just something now. Joe Burrow has a start that did not go well against Pittsburgh. They've got this win now. Hopefully they can start building on some things to even out that rivalry, as well as Baltimore, because, even Cleveland of late, you know, it's been lopsided in the AFC North after, you know, the early and middle parts, and even some of the later years of the Marvin Lewis era. I mean, he kind of dominated the AFC North for the most part. Fared pretty well against the Ravens, did very well against the Browns, did not do well against the Steelers, obviously. But I mean, the division games were, he was pretty sound. Marvin Lewis was. That is not the case at all with, with Zach Taylor, unfortunately. We're gonna get on out of here. Let's drop the mic. John, we got to a lot. We went a little long, but we crammed a ton into this episode. What do you got for us tonight before we bounce on out, my friend?
Yeah, as Anthony mentioned before, we felt it was best to not do the show on Wednesday because of obvious reasons and also for personal reasons. I got a DM, though, on Twitter today. And upon like first reading it or like seeing the first paragraph of it, I was expecting kind of the worst. But it was from Josh Calvacanti, I think I'm saying his name right. Oh, and he's like a producer for the Bengals Brawl podcast, which features James Rapine and Tony Pike. And he essentially he said, you know, I followed you a long time, but I unfollowed you recently because, you know, you just come off as negative to me. And I needed to remove some of those, I guess, that the negative influences in my life. But I realized that, you know, it was a mistake on my part. And I really appreciate, you know, all the work that you and Cincy Jungle do. And, you know, he just sent this really long apology to me. And it really, I don't know, like I just been thinking lately, you know, especially with, I guess, mostly with the Bengals, you know, I think I'm kind of perceived as kind of a Debbie Downer or just a negative, you know, guy or just a realist in general. And I thought to myself, you know, recently, like it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to kind of alleviate some of that stuff and, you know, kind of come off in a more positive and engaging manner. You know, I think our own Matt Minnick does a great job of that. And that's why his following has grown exponentially of late. But, you know, it was nice to get a message like that and for someone who has followed me and us on Sissy Jungle for many years to kind of, you know, come out and kind of say that and bring that honesty. And I really do appreciate that. And anybody else who wants to talk to me, obviously, and communicate with me in that way on Twitter, they're always welcome. But it was really nice, you know, kind of message that he sent. And I really do appreciate that sort of wake up call as we begin this year that hopefully is better than the last.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, he's a good follow too. I think he and I follow each other on Twitter. And I've been accused. I think someone said a handful of weeks ago that I quote unquote, I hate watch the Bengals when I tweet out when I watch games. And I don't mean to be that way. It's just, you know, you watch this team for a long time and, you know, they can wear you down a little bit the way they find ways to lose and stuff. But the bottom line is John and I are passionate about this team. We wouldn't do this show if not. And, you know, we still get blown away by the amount of support that we get for this show and what we do, what Matt does, what Ace and Zim do, the amount of downloads and views. I said this on one of our post-game shows. The amount of views and downloads and guests we had this year and all of that was just really humbling. And I really mean that. And, you know, when I hear someone send you a message like that, John, and see some of the messages in our live chats and stuff, it really does mean a lot. We do try and read as much as we can. We do try and see as many comments as we can and everything. And, you know, seeing that people appreciate what we do and the time that we put into this does mean a lot, because this is a labor of love for sure. I've said that before. And, you know, John and I put the work in here, but, you know, we do this for the listeners and for all of you. So, you know, I guess I'll just kind of piggyback my mic drop on yours a little bit and just say a continued thank you to you, John, and then to the listeners as well. Just, you know, it makes this when the team wins six games in a tie in the last 2 years, it's not always easy coming behind a microphone and giving you all kinds of different stuff, but we try our best. And the fact that we've grown even through all of these rough years, it says a lot. So we appreciate that.
Yeah, that'll do it for us. For Anthony, for me, thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you pretty soon. See you guys next time.